Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedules, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. A bit of feedback from the last episode. Yes, the sound quality wasn't really great in episode 165. A bit of crunchiness, some kind of distortion on my voice. Hopefully this episode is sounding a lot better though. I'm not quite sure the reason for that, but I have been swapping around some bits and pieces for, you know, with an audio setup here, mainly because I've been recording some bits of music and also doing a recording of one of my novels, a narration of one of my novels. So look out for, hopefully in the next few weeks, a different kind of file might pop up here in the feed, in the SFBRP feed. There might be an audio book of Get That Rat Off My Face, which is a novella that I wrote earlier this year. Was it late last year? I can't remember. But it's published. You can read it as an ebook file or a text file, but soon I will be putting out an EPUB version and also an audio version. So that'll be coming along shortly, hopefully. So getting on to today's episode, today I'm going to be reviewing it's not as much a novel, it's more like an omnibus of short stories called Wool by Hugh Howey. And this is a five different stories. It's kind of like a fix-up novel, but it's not really presented as a novel, say like Accelerando by Charles Stross was. I read it thinking it was a novel, but this is very much, it says, yes, these are going to be five short stories set with the same world or the same character, telling an overarching story. And that's what it gets. So it starts off, there's a book called Wool, which was a short story, which was first published by Hugh Howey. He's like this, I guess the term for him is an indie author. He's a self-published author publishing just through Kindle. And I've noticed this on Amazon, you know, and it's sort of like on the top of the Kindle ebook charts and things. But also about five or six different people have emailed me and messaged me on goodreads.com saying, hey, you should really check this out. It's really good. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't really like review short stories. But then a few months ago, he released the first five books, like I say, as an omnibus. So as a kind of a book, as a single file. So I checked it out. And it was only a few dollars, so yeah, nothing go wrong. And I started reading it on my iPhone, as a Kindle ebook, in the Kindle Reader app, I guess. And so yeah, let's get straight into it. So this is set in a world which is set in, of course, in the future. It's science fiction, and all of the action takes place in a silo. And this it's like they call it a silo. It's like this nuclear bunker or this bomb shelter that's deep underground, and again, unspecified time in the future. But and this bunker is again, it's difficult because there's the thing about this series of books is that there could be lots and lots of spoilers. I could spoil like just by saying a few facts now could spoil a lot of the impact for this, because this book is kind of written about the mystery of what this nuclear bunker is and how big it is and why it is, you know, why it is as it is and what the people are doing there and why people are trapped inside and why they can't get out. So I'm going to keep some of this review vague, but I do want to talk a little bit about this. So it's like a skyscraper. It's that deep. It's like 150 levels tall or deep into the ground, and on the top level is where the sheriff's office, and a few levels down is where the mayor of the silo lives, and then sort of on the lower levels down is the IT department, who and the IT department have got these all these files. So the idea is being that, like, after some kind of unspecified apocalypse, everyone in this big silo, a few thousand people in the silo, are, you know, like this ark, and once the outside world is livable again, they'll all come out of it. So IT is keeping a storage of lots and lots and lots of data, which is going to be coming in very handy once they can go outside. So that's kind of like a library as well. And then deep in the bowels of the silo, there's sort of like this all the mechanical stuff goes on down there, the air purification and the electricity generation and all that kind of stuff goes on deep in the lower levels. So it's like level one is at the top, lower level 150 something is down at the very bottom of it. And and also in the top level, and this is, I'm not spoiling anything here, but in the top of the level number one, there is this large kind of cantina kind of area, this large open area where people go to get food, and around the outside of this this canteen is lots of screens, so people can see out and they can see what the weather conditions are outside. There's some cameras up on the up in the open space above this silo, pointing in different directions, and the people at the top can actually see out via these screens. So that's kind of like the settings. When I first started reading this, I wasn't quite sure if it was a dystopia or not. Because I was thinking, well, it's post-apocalyptic. Maybe it's just people trying to get on with stuff. Because there's lots of post-apocalyptic stories which could be thought of as a dystopia. But then there's other things like the Chrysalids, which starts off and actually is quite nice, you know, even though you realize that it's like there's lots of radiation and lots of mutants. It's actually quite a nice existence. And as the book goes on, you slowly realize actually how much of a dystopia it is, how much of the society and thought, the society is set up to be ruled by thought crimes, and they rewrite history and include arbitrary laws and all this other kind of Orwellian stuff, which makes up like a classic dystopian setting. And again, I wasn't quite sure where this was going, but of course it does get into those kind of areas as you read throughout the book. And again, I don't want to give too much away here, because as we go through these different stories, each story unfolds or unravels, if you will, a little bit more of the history, a little bit more of actually what's going on, a little bit more of the conspiracies behind it, none of which I actually want to go into here. But let's go through the stories one by one. And so it starts off with the sheriff. And the sheriff's wife a few years before went out to what's called a cleaning. And the cleaning is, if you're let me put it this way. Every few years, the cameras out on the surface, they get some, the gunk builds up of them over the few years. And the people in that top level, when they go up to see the outside world, because lots of people kind of make a pilgrimage up there every few months or every year or something to see the outside world. But what happens is that there's too much gunk on the cameras and they need cleaning. So if there's a really bad criminal who needs to like some excessive punishment, they get sent outside. And by going outside, it's a one-way trip, let me put it this way. But you go outside and you have a bit of wool with you, and you kind of go and clean the cameras, and then try and make your way in the outside world. And invariably the outside world is way too the atmosphere is way too corrosive for any kind of protection that you can wear, and also because it's a punishment, you're not quite sure how much of that is down to the actual bad atmosphere. Of course it is, but there's other factors involved, because like I say, it is meant to be a punishment. But also, if you're just tired of this, and one of the main themes of this novel is like, well, are humans really designed to live for generations and generations and generations under the ground? And of course the answer is no. So to let off steam, sometimes, if someone is causing trouble, they can say, I want to get out. I'm going to take my chances in the outside world, and they can go off. And what happens is there's a sheriff who's one of the most important people in the entire silo underground. She said, hey, I want to get out of here. And you're like, well, why does she want to get out of here? And the first story sort of investigates why the sheriff's wife wanted to go out, and also the kind of sheriff is wondering if he should follow her as he tracks down more of the secrets that his wife also uncovered. He's sort of following the trail as an investigator, trying to work out why his wife thought it would be a good idea to go outside. And that's kind of the basic idea, or it kind of sets up the major rules and the dynamic between the mayor and the sheriff doing their best to kind of run the place, and that's kind of weird IT department who are obviously obstructing some things and keeping other things secret. There is, of course, a big twist at the end of this first story, which is why when I ask people, hey, what's Wool about? When people recommend a book to me, I say, well, tell me about it. And they say, well, I can't really tell you about it because I don't want to spoil it. But there is a twist, of course, at the end of this, of story number one. And I must admit, I did already guess what the twist was going to be, but it wasn't like obvious. I'd already guessed it. I had it as a possibility, but I also had like two other main possibilities of what could actually be happening in the outside world. But I'm not going to outline any of them, because I guess if you don't think of the twist, if you don't think about what the twist could be, or even now I'm telling you there's a twist, but even if you don't guess what the twist is, I guess it's going to be really effective. And in the way that I actually don't like spoiling books, sometimes because I like to be fooled. If there's a good twist at the end of a book or at the end of a story and I don't work it out, I actually feel really good that someone gets one over on me. But then if I do work it out, I like to feel intelligent. And this was a book that actually let me feel intelligent, especially in this first story. But then there's other twists as we go throughout, which I didn't see coming, and other things where I was like, oh yeah. And in turn, this book made me feel really, really clever by guessing what the big twist was going to be, and then also really, really stupid for not seeing other big twists, and then again really, really clever for working out some points, and then again really stupid for missing some other really obvious things. And that's why I don't like spoiling books, because I like other people to have the same satisfaction of being shocked and of being surprised, and of course also let people feel intelligent or stupid as they go through. But just say that's what this book, one of the main strengths of this book is that it can surprise you and it can also make you feel stupid, and yet it can challenge you in a way that you can bring enough to the book to feel accomplished as a knowledgeable reader or as a careful reader in your own right. So the first story can be just read as a standalone story, and I guess that's why this book has been a big success, because people read that story and go, wow, that was awesome. It works so well just as a small unit of fiction, but I do want to read more. And normally I don't like those most standalone short stories, because they set up a world or they set up some characters and things, and you're like, oh, I really want to continue with these characters, or I really want to continue with this world. And so often you can't get that. You don't get that like long-term satisfaction of really exploring in depth something with all those different elements, you know, that you can explore the world and the characters and the themes and the action and the technology and all that kind of stuff. Normally you don't get that chance with a short story. However, here you can read straight on to story number two, which the story number two, we get the mayor and another character from the first story, like the sheriff's deputy. They make a long trip down from level one all the way down into the very deep depths, like down to level like 150 or 140 or whatever it is, and then all the way back up again. And this is a great story for setting. In the first one, we get like the basic outline of the world, but here we get loads and loads and loads of details as they take a few days to travel right from the very top all the way down to the bottom, and then all the way back up to the top again, and the people they meet along the way and the things they do along the way and the technology that they see in all the settings. And this was where I really suddenly like this book really caught me, because the first one's like a cute short story, and when I started doing this I was like, wow, there is a lot of history here. Hugh Howey, the author, has put a lot of thought into this, because there's all of these major inconsistencies. And again, I don't want to spoil it, I'll just bring up one inconsistency. I was thinking, well, why is it taking them so long to get down there? Like, it's only 150 floors, isn't it? But then you realize, oh, it's not 150 floors, it's 150 levels. And then I was like, well, why is it taking so long? It takes ever, and it's really weird. Because the levels are actually spaced out a long, long way. And of course, I don't want to get too much into the details of why that is. But Hugh Howey kind of describes so many things obliquely, which, like, for the characters involved, they don't see anything wrong with it. It's just like, well, yeah, this is the way it works. Or this is the way the world is. Yeah, this is how it goes. But like, as a careful reader, you've got like a different set of facts, because you've got a different set of expectations to what to see. When something doesn't jibe with your expectations, the characters don't notice it, and the author doesn't bring any attention to it. But you, as the reader, go, wait a second, there's something else going on here. For example, with Alistair Reynolds' Terminal World, is set on a future Mars, and in I mentioned this in my review, because it's very obviously, you know, you've got all the different geography there, you've got less gravity, you don't have any magnetic north, it even tells a story of the Spirit and Opportunity rovers landing and going around and doing their own little thing there and carrying on. I guess the Mars Curiosity Land, or the Mars, what is it, the Mars Science Lab or whatever it's called now, that's not mentioned in Terminal World, which dates the book, of course, but you get all these really great references to Mars as a real place, and lots of references to science fiction written about Mars. And of course you're like, there's mention, but it's never mentioned in the book. And of course, The Book of the New Sun, which I just started listening to the audiobook of the first book again, it's really obvious that it's set, you know, the people live on a spaceport and they live in these metal towers, but they're actually, you know, rockets, or at least spaceships, and there's like, they describe this picture of of a guy with a white suit in a desert, and there's a flagpole next to him, and you can see a reflection in the shiny helmet, and you're like, well, that's a picture of Buzz Aldrin on the moon. But it's not described like that, and the characters don't know that, and the author never explicitly states what it is, but you as a good reader will pick that out. So, of course, I'm using these examples for other books because I don't want to say too much about this setting, but there's so many things hinted at, little things to pick up on, which are, of course, explained mostly in the stories 4 and 5 within this omnibus, and it kind of fleshes out the wider conspiracy and the history of the silo. There isn't so much of a twist at the end of the story, but there is like a revelation and some stuff. Again, I don't want to talk it. And again, if you stop reading there, it would work as a standalone novel, but unlike the first one, where you could kind of stop and be satisfied that it was a complete story, this one, you really want to know what comes next. You're like, so many questions are raised within that last, you know, few pages of book number two story number two, you really want to go on. But I guess if you wanted to, you could stop there. Story number three, the sheriff has to investigate some deaths and it gets a bit too close to some secrets that the IT department doesn't want known. Again, I don't want to get too much into this, but this ends on a cliffhanger. And at this point, there is like no attempt at all to show this is like a standalone novel. This is very much setting up stories number 4 and 5. And it's also longer as well. The first two stories are quite short, but stories 3, 4, and 5 are much more kind of like novella length stories rather than just a short story, so they each take a few hours to read through rather than the first one, which takes probably, you know, 45 minutes or something. So yeah, by story three, it really is very much of a serial novel rather than just some short story. What have I got here? Story four, I've made some notes here to keep track. Yeah, story four, the viewpoint kind of splits apart in this story, because beforehand it was mostly told from the point of view of one character each, whereas here it splits apart to include, we're still following the sheriff, and there's some mechanics that we, in depths of the silo, and also this young technician in the IT department. And that's really great, because now we can get some real revelations from what's going on, like, inside the silo at the different levels all at the same time, and kind of also what's going on in the IT department. And then story five really, like, culminates, like, continues yet culminates a lot of the action and of the previous story. Even though it's set at quite, you know, a while after story number four, they do lead into each other very nicely. And I think this one is not the weakest of all of them, but it kind of bogged down a bit at the beginning with some unnecessary drama, stuff which didn't really add a whole lot to the overall plot. But even though the action itself was very exciting and it was claustrophobic and you're never quite sure what's going to go on, you know, or where it's going to lead them, or if there is going to be any big revelations. And it was needed in a way for the plot, but it kind of slowed it down a bit. And I think this is actually mostly because it's I was reading it as like one story after another, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and reading it kind of as a novel. Whereas I think if you'd have read stories like, you know, one, and then waited a month, and then two, and then wasted another month, because this is what you're meant to do. You're meant to buy them as they come out on the, you know, as they come out into the Kindle store. Then you read number four, and then you're waiting a few months. So when you get back into story number five, like me reading one straight after the other, I just wanted to pick straight off and just get on with it. But actually, what you really want to do is kind of like ease your way back into it again. So that's not anything against story number five, I don't think, but I just wanted it to carry on, and it didn't. Of course, by the end of story five, most of the questions have been answered, but there's still bits and pieces which are left over. Again, the plot and the characters are sort of moving in surprising directions in the end, but also very satisfying directions. And it also, book number five, story number five within in the Wool Omnibus, it kind of starts restricting the viewpoint characters again, which allows for new twists in a way, because like in book number four, you're kind of aware of like everything that's going on all the way up and down the silo, or maybe that's happening as well at the beginning of story five as well. You're pretty much aware of everything that's going on. I mean, there's still stuff to find out, but like the end of the story kind of, like I say, restricts those viewpoints, and by doing so, reveal stuff in interesting ways as characters find out what's happened to other characters, and the characters kind of come across each other in unexpected ways. So I kept the names of the characters concealed all the way through there, because for each story, let me put it this way, the main character doesn't always make it through to the end, and sometimes the secondary characters don't always make it through to the end, and also in other times the story will end and you're not quite sure if somebody is dead or alive, or you're not quite sure if they're about to die or if they are about to live, or if they're about to be saved, or if they're about to give their life for a cause in a different way. And I don't want to spoil, and this is why I haven't concentrated on any specific characters, because I don't want to spoil who might live and who might die, because in a way, that's one of the main strengths of the book. And the reason why it's one of the main strengths is actually the characters themselves, who I don't really want to talk about too much for fear of spoiling it. The reason why the stories work and that they're so effective is that you really, really care about the characters. They're very well drawn. They have like individual desires and individual motivations. And like as you go through, you're thinking, oh well, maybe yeah, she did this, or she had this love, or he did this, or he was doing that. And it sounds a bit like vague as you read the first stories, but as you get through the book, you realize that what were actually these very, very personal and unique motivations, like character motivations and desires, have quite large plot and thematic significance later on in ways that I thought was amazing. And it's certainly more poignant that, like, someone who you like, of course, like someone who you really like spending time with is gonna die, maybe. And again, because you don't know who is going to die, that makes all of the action sequences way more important, because, you know, people, like, so this person could die or that person could die. Well, who is that? And again, I don't want to spoil if somebody dies or when they die or how they die or anything like that, but that kind of stuff becomes way more important. Like, the characters are so important and you care about them so much because they are fragile, they are damageable, they can get hurt, they can die, unlike a lot of novels. But again, I guess that same thing happens in a lot of dystopias as well. So technology, I didn't make any notes here, but technology, there's lots of different levels of technology. In the depths, you've got the miners and the drillers and the engineers and the mechanics and stuff. And then at the top level, like in information technology, you've got all these, you've got these computer servers. Like I said before, there's like all these data that they're saving. But the cool thing is that history has been kind of rewritten to obscure just what is and what isn't possible with the technology that is available to some people, like guns. Like, no, there's a great point at one, the great thing at one point is like, oh, guns. Nobody knows how to, you know, guns have been restricted. There's no plans for how to build guns or anything like that. Except when people need to build guns, it's like everyone knows how to build guns. So even though that's like restricted technology, it seems like everyone just has like what they think a gun should be like in their mind, left over from these previous uprisings and things like that. And so suddenly when they need guns, they'll get guns. But what's possible? You know, what are other people going to be doing in other parts of the silo? If you're getting guns, what are they going to be building over there? Maybe they've got access to other technology or other records of other technology. And I really like this kind of thing because it feels like to me, and I'm not sure if this is the truth or not, and this is just my speculation, but it feels like these silos, the silo that they have here is like it's been dug in the 1980s and maybe 1970s or 1980s. So most of the technology which keeps it going is actually quite low technology, not a lot of electronics or anything like that. But then the Cold War ended or whatever's going on, and then there's this apocalypse, but the apocalypse obviously happened sometime in the 21st century. So there's this like baseline of 1970s, 1980s technology with this kind of sprinkling of other technology that kind of seeped into the silo over the years, and what it was stocked up with before all hell broke loose outside or whatever, you know, cataclysmic disaster struck that forced people to go down into this silo. So I like the different levels of things there. And, and of course, there's a lot of people with their little human ingenuity building stuff from scratch, you know, like tying bits of string here and sticking things together there and using Velcro here and tape here. And I like all those little details of these little, like they say, the human ingenuity kind of things. Because what if an author gets those kind of things right, you can kind of forgive any, like, wider things. Like, well, how does this work? Well, how do they feed all these people? How do they get air in there? And you can just go, oh, there's some air purification. You're like, oh, okay. But because, like I say, when he answers these little small questions, which means he doesn't have to worry about some of the bigger technological problems, which I do think there are some of these, but again, they don't get in the way of the plot. They don't get in the way of the characters. They're just there. And I reckon if I actually asked Hugh Howey, the author, and said, well, what about this factor? What about that factor? He could say, oh, it's actually about this. And I'll probably go, okay. So I can just trust him that he's got all of this thought out, even if it doesn't, some things aren't that clear to me. The writing is very well written, and I think the stories actually get better as they go along, as the scope opens out. I really did like the very tight viewpoint and the very personal character of the stories earlier on. But you do need to widen it out if you're going to tell a bigger story about the entire society. I do like how that, I say, the scope opens out, even when it does open out, we're focusing on different characters, but yet they're still very individual characters. I think book 4 is the weakest in this way, where a character comes in, you're just like, oh, who was this again? Oh, they were mentioned over here. Oh, well, okay, I guess I'll follow them. But there's nothing more than like I'll follow them. And like when you're spending time with them, it feels a bit like, oh yeah, okay, we're spending time down here because we've got to know what's going on down there. But really, you're wanting to get back up to the other characters at the other end of the silo. And like I say, because the characters are so well written, as they get into different situations, it can really have an effect on me. I don't think I cried at any point. You know, it takes a lot for a book to move me to tears. But there's lots of stuff, and the descriptions of like the claustrophobic situations that they get into them is, you know, really got to me in some points. You're very frightened for the characters. Again, that comes back to not being afraid that. The author isn't afraid to put them in real risk and have real consequences hitting his characters. But the writing and the situations and how he writes those situations is very, very powerful. But overall, I do think the language is pretty simple. Very approachable, very accessible, let me put it that way. It feels like this could become a book which is studied by school children in English classes. Like, I remember some books that I read for school, like it was 1984, I think that was a book that I read at school. Maybe I just read it at school, not for a lesson. But there was another one, Z for Zachariah, if you're American, another post-apocalyptic thing. And maybe a book, like I mentioned before, like The Chrysalids and things, these kind of post-apocalyptic books which are said, talking about a dystopian society with these strong characters and an easy and accessible writing. I think this book fits that mold, and that's probably quite a good lineup of books to emulate. Well, not maybe emulate, but be classed with as well. Finally, what have I got here? Some nice covers in the books too. Just look at them. Yeah, the themes of the book, which I normally wrap my reviews up with, there's a whole lot about, you know, human spirit and battling against the odds, and, you know, the whole idea of, like, are humans designed to be kept in holes in the ground? Probably not. But there's a whole other section which really hits on things that I, you know, enjoy thinking about, which is, you know, fate is mentioned quite a lot. There's this quote which comes up quite a bit, which says, you know, fate put us here. It's like, no, there's no such thing as fate. Or no, you go, even if there is such a thing as fate, it's what you do when you're there. It's not that fate got you there. It's what you choose to do when you're there. It's your actions when you're there which really count. Totally butchered that quote. I think I had the Wikipedia page for this open. I think that was mentioned there as well. Yeah. What we control is our actions once fate puts us there. So that's it. What we control is that our actions once fate puts us there. So even if fate exists or not, that doesn't really matter. That's no excuse. When you're in a situation, it's what you do which really counts. And this is really interesting for me because there's a big theme in these all the way through these books about faith and belief. Like if you're in a situation where you can't believe history, if you're in a situation where you can't believe anything that you're told, in a 1984, if you live in Oceania or, you know, in the Big Brother is telling you one thing and actually the opposite might be true. What you believe, it might match up with the stated reality, but it probably doesn't match up with the real reality. And this is actually something I've written about before on my blog, and I've probably talked about it before in a podcast, which is the idea that belief for me doesn't have a lot of value, because belief is the thing that no matter how much you believe you're right, doesn't actually affect the world in the slightest. And again, I can't remember if I've told this story before on the podcast, but there's this whole idea of like, which side of the road do you drive on in India? So we go to India, you're going to drive on the left or the right. Now, you might have a belief about that one, about one way. Maybe you believe they drive on the right. Maybe you believe they drive on the left. But what you actually believe doesn't matter at all. Once you get there, you'll have to actually, you know. And it's what you know when you get there, which you actually act on, which is a thing which means you'll either die or not. And when I first went to India, I landed the plane at the airport. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I got in this taxi, and this taxi driver was driving me along. And it turns out that even what I believed, you know, I believe they drove on the left in India, it turns out that's what the law says, but what it really turns out is that people don't really give a fuck which side of the road that you're meant to be driving, because he was driving sometimes on the left, sometimes on the right. You know, there'd be a dual carriage, right? Just swing across the other side of the dual carriage, right? Go down that bit. Oh, yeah, there's a car coming the other way. And when the car's coming the other way, you should sort of like veer to the left, and he veers to the left, and you both miss each other. No consideration about that. Just keep driving, you know, and just whoever gets out of the way gets out of the way. They could be going left or could be going right. Could be cows walking through or anything like that. And it's one of those situations that, sure, there's a rule. There's something that you could believe in. But when you're actually in the situation, belief goes out of the window. Facts hit you real, and even assumptions go out of the window, and facts hit you for real. And the reason why I'm telling this story rather than using an example from the book is that I don't want to give away the stuff that goes in here, but your belief has exactly zero effect on the real world. And again, what it says, it's what you do once you get there which actually has the effect. It's your beliefs you don't have any control over, because, you know, if you don't have enough knowledge, if you don't have enough knowledge to actually come up with a real decision, with a real knowledge or anything like that, you're left with a belief which is, you know, pretty much worthless, because a belief is something that you don't know enough about yet to actually make a firm decision of action. And you can act on your beliefs, which can turn out great and can turn out not so great. You know, it's one of those things. And this novel is pretty much an entire five books of people believing something and then acting on it, and sometimes it turns out great. And then the other people believe something else and they act on it, and sometimes it doesn't work out for themselves. And some people decide, oh, let's do it this way, and it ends disastrously. And other people like act on their emotions and it ends this way, and it leads loads of people to their deaths. And I can't blame anyone in this novel for believing what they do. I mean, I used to believe all kinds of crazy stuff. I was brought up as a Christian, and also I was brought up, well, you know, when you're a kid, you believe all kinds of stuff, and you're like, oh, you know, dogs can't look up, you know, well, they can look up, well, can dogs look up, you know, all these different things that people believe, maybe because they haven't examined it enough, maybe it's impossible to examine your beliefs, but then they act on them anyway. And what this book is like people trying to work out not what they believe, because what they believe has no impact. What they believe doesn't matter. They're actually trying to find out the reality of the situation. And a lot of people in this novel act on what they believe to try and change the future. They have a belief about the future, have how they want the future to turn out, but they act on their beliefs about the world as it is now, and it turns out that doesn't work very well. And there's other people who discard their beliefs and actually work for real knowledge about what's going on now, and then when they work on it, actually some stuff can come around. And I like the idea that doesn't matter what fate gets you, the kind of idea that, you know, it doesn't matter what fate does. It's when you're in a situation, what set of facts are you going to work with? Are your facts going to line up with the real world and you're going to be able to influence the future, or are your facts not going to line up with the real world? And if they don't line up with the real world, you're not going to be able to affect the future. So there's a whole lot of that kind of stuff going on in this book. There's lots and lots of other stuff going on here. But that's one thing that really stands out for me early on in the stories. But then once it was in my mind, I kept on seeing more and more explorations of this as I read through the novel. Of course, these are some of my own views and my own formulation of what's going on in the book. But there are quite a few things which are quite... the same idea is like talked about by the characters in different ways and plays out with the actions of the book in different ways as well, which I found very, very interesting. So that's going to wrap up my review. I think there's not a lot wrong with this at all. I mean, the only thing which I think could have improved it in some way is that like it's slightly uneven, but it's actually a series of short stories. So I think the pacing, any of the pacing issues that I had in this, as if it was a single novel, that would actually be quite a knock against it. But because it's not a single novel, it is actually a series. It's like a serial novel, a series of short stories or a series of novellas. Like the pacing issues, I think, can be forgiven because each individual story is very, very well told. And the unevenness of some of it, like I said before, like they got this like very tight viewpoint characters. Like there's one viewpoint character in the first story and one in the second story. And in the third story, I can't remember if there's one or two. But then in the fourth story, there's like three four viewpoint characters in the fifth story as well. But I think that if you'd have actually put more viewpoint characters in the first short story and actually started it off with like telling the sheriff's story at the top and telling the mechanic story down at the bottom and telling the IT guy story in the middle, the first story just wouldn't work at all. And if you actually started to write a novel in that way, the impact of that first short story, which is the thing that keeps you in and the thing that makes you want to read all the way through to the end of the fifth story, that wouldn't have had any impact at all, which is a real pity. I say it's a real pity. It would be a pity to rewrite that first story as a novel, and I think it works a lot better as, you know, starting off as a short story and then continuing with another short story and then opening up into sort of like the a story with the scope of a novel or a novel with that larger scope. So, of course, now it's finished. Or it's not finished, but the first five books, there's Wool. Oh, let me actually just read off the title here. They're here on Wikipedia. So it goes, Wool, published back in like July last year. And Wool 2, Proper Gauge. Wool 3, Casting Off. Wool 4, The Unraveling, that came out in December. Wool 5, The Stranded. That was in January. And then they were collected together into an omnibus, which I think came out as blah, 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 blah. Say April time. And then it says here, Wool 6, First Shift, which came out in April as well. So that's Wool 6. So I think I'm going to wait until the next maybe four or five Wool stories have been gathered together, and then I'll read them all the way through as well, because I don't think I could cope with just reading a bit and then ending on one of these cliffhangers that he throws in here, or one of these mysteries that he throws in. I'm not going to do that. It's pretty good. He's got this First Shift Legacy, the sixth book in the Silo series, which is the Wool. I guess the Silo series. He's changing the name. Maybe he's trying to sell it or something. Because Wool is a really great name for the first short story. Not so much a great name for the second story. And overall, I don't think it's a great name for the series. But it's the series we've got. But I guess he's trying to make it be called a Silo story rather than a Wool story, because the Wool idea is pretty much played out there. So I'm going to give this 4.5 stars because I thoroughly enjoyed it. Have I got any other notes here? No, I just ended up with saying I want to read another novel, not another short story, not another novella. I want to read another novel length set of fictional scenes and characters, blah, blah, blah. So Hugh Harry, get on that, please. And I'm probably going to check out some of his other novel length fiction, maybe some other short stories. I guess he's got some standalone novels, I, Zombie, and some other ones which I can't read the titles of. So I'll check them out as well at some point, I'm sure. A really great writer. So thanks a lot for listening to this. I hope you enjoyed this review. If you've got any feedback about this or anything else, email me, luke@juggler.net. Also, get over to goodreads.com and you can respond by like to this podcast directly there. Just go to there's some links in the blog post for this, and on my website as well. You can click straight across to my review of Wool, and there you can discuss it with other people. people. So normally when I post a review or a link to my podcast there on goodreads.com, there's normally about 10, 15 people, different people put messages there. And there's normally a good discussion about the books I was talking about. Let me see here. Let's bring up here Goodreads. So I mentioned the last book that I read, which was a splinter of the Mind's Eye, and quite a few people have got onto that one, and they're talking about the different comics that were made of it and this and that. Internet's not working at the moment. And lots of people are saying, let me just bring this up here. So anyway, I'm just saying that you can discuss with other listeners of the podcast. There's Tamer, Keith, Sean, Peter, Thomas, Keith again, Michael, and PM. So Michael wrote, I have a copy of this that I picked up at a half-price books for a quarter on a clearance that I haven't read yet. I should read it before I listen to your review. And I replied, no, you shouldn't read it before you listen to my review. Read Wool before you listen to this review if you want to. Not that it's possible now. But don't read Splinter of the Mind's Eye before you listen to my review, because I think that clears up a lot about that. Anyway, again, thanks a lot for listening. I hope you enjoyed this, and I'll catch you next time.